In chapter 22 now, it's coming to a head. Obviously, the ministry of Jesus, the life and times of Jesus, it's all coming to a head now with his soon arrest and betrayal, arrest, and then crucifixion and resurrection. The purpose for which he came into the world is going to unfold. But before he goes to the cross, he spends this last night, intimate night with his disciples, in which we know as the time when he celebrated that Passover service and instituted communion or the Lord's Supper. And we see that whole picture here. But it's not just an evening of celebrating this as a ceremony. There is an evening of revelation. Revelation into what's going to take place. So what's going to happen initially with the betrayer. And the revelation into the heart of these disciples as they still have a lot of selfishness there. And how Peter will deny him. And then the tough times to come. So the whole package is quite an interesting insight into what's happening around Jesus as he is getting ready to go to the cross. In verse 1, it starts, "Now the feast of the unleavened bread drew near," which is called Passover. Technically, Passover is the first day of the feast of unleavened bread, which lasts for 7 days. And it's a celebration that commemorates the time when Israel was in Egypt as slaves and they were brought out of Egypt. After Moses came to tell Pharaoh to let his people go, Pharaoh hardened his heart, and after the 10 plagues, the 10th plague was that final straw, the night that the firstborn were killed in Egypt. And yet God made a provision that as many as would take a lamb and take its blood after it was slain and sprinkle that blood with hyssop on the doorposts and on the lintel of their house, the angel of death then would pass over that house and they would be spared that horrible tragedy. Those who believed did, the Egyptians did not, and they lost the firstborn throughout all of Egypt. And this became the final straw. They finally obeyed God and thrust forth the people of Israel, sent them out, loaded them down with all kinds of gold and silver and said, "Hey, get out of here. We don't want you anymore." So they left and went across the Red Sea, of course. Interestingly enough, in the last week, I think there was a special on this. And it's amazing these scholarly types are still trying to present that crazy idea that it wasn't the Red Sea, it was the Reed Sea. And it was only a couple feet of water. So a nice strong wind came and separated the waters a little bit and the people were able to go through. I'm amazed that scholars still hold on to that fallacy. They don't think it through. I mean, it's amazing to think that these intelligent people who study these things and they present this documentary, this special on TV, haven't thought of the obvious, the ridiculousness of the entire Egyptian army drowning in 2 feet of water. I have a hard time with understanding how they can miss that obvious point. So you have to be careful when you're watching these documentaries because obviously there's a bias that goes so strong as to miss the obvious facts. Well, this is the evening. The Passover meal was given by God to commemorate this. He didn't want them to forget what he did for them, so he gave them this meal. Now, the Passover also represents a greater act of deliverance of God. Certainly that act of delivering Egypt, the millions of people as slaves through the wilderness into the promised land, is an amazing feat, but it's nothing compared to the deliverance that God has for each individual to be rescued from the law of sin and death, from the punishment of hell, to be saved out of this world, brought into his marvelous light, and be adopted into his family, that of salvation. And in a way, this is what Jesus is going to instruct his disciples in, what the Passover is really all about here. So it was about ready to take place, and as it was about, the chief priests and the scribes sought how they might kill him, for they feared the people. So they're seeking a way to destroy Jesus, but they have to do it very carefully, because if they just stone him, the people will turn on them and they'll be stoned. Now, later they do. They just stone Stephen, and they kill a number of the early believers, because the people, of course, we're divided on this issue, but at this point, many of the people are behind Jesus. So they're trying to find a way to destroy him because they feared the people. They had to do it carefully. Then Satan entered Judas, surnamed Iscariot, who was numbered among the 12. Judas, the traitor, So he went his way and conferred with the chief priests and the captains, that would be the temple guards, how he might betray him to them. And they were glad and agreed to give him money. So he promised and sought opportunity to betray him to them in the absence of the multitude. You know, he knew all the secret places, so he could tell them where to be and pick him up so that it would not be a public event. It would be secretly. Amazing, this person, Judas. Showing his true colors here. Having been with Jesus for 3 years, yet his heart was thoroughly interested in himself, not in the truth. He wanted a position, obviously. He wanted some fame. He wanted some recognition. He wanted some power. And he realizes Jesus is not going to go in the direction that he was hoping. He doesn't like all this servant stuff. He wants something a little more significant for himself. And so he realizes he's jumping ship at this point. And he picks up a little few extra bucks in doing so, of course, selling Jesus into the hands of the chief priests, betraying him for 30 pieces of silver, Matthew tells us, which actually was the price of a slave and was actually predicted in Zechariah chapter 12, verse 11. Fascinating passage, actually 11, verse 12. I want to get that straight. If you read that, it's an insight into this, that he counted out 30 pieces of silver, a goodly sum for his person, and then he threw it to the house of the potter. Now, what we find that happened with this money was very similar. When Judas had remorse after he did his dirty deed and betrayed Jesus, he took the money and he threw it back in the temple. Well, the chief priests thought, well, they had to be holy. They couldn't use that money because it was blood money for the temple. So they took it and bought a potter's field in which to bury poor people in, thus fulfilling that very interesting passage. Well, then came the day of, by the way, just a note on Judas. Why would he do this? You know, sometimes we read and see things about him that is presented in a way that he was really a good guy. He was just misguided and, misunderstood Jesus. And he really was hoping perhaps to press Jesus' hand to be the Messiah. And they paint him in all this good light, unfortunately. But the Bible describes him that really he was just a common thief. He pilfered money from the treasury that he was in charge of. He got his hands in the cookie jar, so to speak. You know, he got into the money. And he loved that, and when he protested that the expensive perfume that Mary had wasted, he said, on Jesus, that could have been sold and given to the money given to the poor. He said this not because he cared about the poor, but because he thought, boy, that's a nice chunk of change I could get my hands on, you know, because he controlled the treasury. Well, he obviously had unbelief, but the real problem here is that he sold himself so much into his sin that Satan entered him. At what point does a person come to a place where Satan enters them? Well, when you sell yourself into this world in the flesh, you very easily become more susceptible to satanic oppression and perhaps even deep possession if you get to that point. Obviously, it's a point where you make a choice to follow the flesh and follow Satan. And here Judas has sold himself. Now, who knows what was the motive for this, of him letting Satan come into his life. Satan is a deceiver. Maybe he promised him power or notoriety, as he deceives many young people today. But think about that. You know, if Satan came to Judas and said, you know what, if you do this, your name will be known for all generations. Well, he told the truth, didn't he? Didn't tell him what his name would be known for. You know, it's amazing when I think about that. I mean, you know, there's lots of people that are named Peter and Paul and James. I mean, how many Peters here, just out of curiosity? Any Peters? Any Johns? A lot of Johns? Okay. Pauls? Any Pauls? All right, there's a few here. Now, any Judases? No? No Judases? Why not? Can you imagine a mother naming her child Judas? I mean, it's like, you don't do that. I mean, his name certainly became very noted, but it's sad what he is known for. Tragic. In fact, Jesus warns, woe to that person who betrays. But he goes on to that in the next passage. Now, let's jump into this preparation for this day, the preparation for the Last Supper. We see the plot is there now, the preparation for the supper, verse 7. Then came the day of unleavened bread when the Passover must be killed. That was the day that, in other words, they would get prepared for the Passover. They'd You have to take the lamb down to the temple and have it properly slain according to the prescribed way, and then the animal would then be brought back, the meat would be brought back, and it would be roasted for the meal. They had to prepare the herbs and the various spices, and they had to get the table and the room ready, and all this stuff came to be prepared. And he sent Peter and John saying, "Go and prepare the Passover for us that we may eat." So they said to him, "Well, where do you want us to prepare?" And he said to them, "Behold, when you have entered the city, a man will meet you carrying a pitcher of water. Follow him into the house which he enters. And then you shall say to the master of the house, 'The teacher says to you, where is the guest room where I may eat the Passover with my disciples?' Then he'll show you a large furnished upper room. There make ready." So they went and found it just as he had said to them, and they prepared the Passover. Now there's a blending here, perhaps, of the natural and the supernatural. Obviously, to me, it would make sense that Jesus knew this person and made arrangements for the room to be available ahead of time. However, that is a very remarkable thing in that fact that throughout Jerusalem, there were literally millions that have crowded into that little city in preparation for this. How do we know how many people were there? Interestingly enough, a historian by the name of Josephus says that the emperor actually took a census of how many lambs that were slain for the Passover. And in doing so, he knew that according to the Mosaic law that you required to have 10 people in order to have one lamb sacrificed and prepared for the meal. So you had to have 10 in order to have a lamb. So he knew that for every lamb there represented at least 10 people, if not more. And they recorded that there were 256,500 lambs that were slain, estimating that in Jerusalem in that time there were well over 2.5 million people, if not up to 3 million people, swelling the city. Now, where are you going to find a room in that kind of crowd? Obviously, there had to be make arrangements beforehand. However, notice the supernatural blending. He sends his disciples in. Now, think about this for a minute. The chief priests cannot find Jesus when they're privately together. I mean, there's too many people to track him down. He's sending his disciples into this city that's swelling with people preparing for the Passover. Everybody's getting ready for the Passover. And he sends them in, and he says, "Now when you see a man carrying a pitcher of water, follow him, and then he's going to take you to ask the people about the upper room, and it'll be the right one." I find that very interesting. It is not usual that a man would be carrying water. That was a woman's job in that culture. A man might carry water with skins, but never with a pitcher of water in his head. That was the feminine way to do it. So I can imagine as they're walking in the city thinking, "Now where are we? Look at that guy. He's carrying water. Oh, that's who we're supposed to find." You know, it probably stuck out, a man carrying water. So they followed him, and sure enough, it all worked out just as Jesus had said. Well, when the hour had come, he sat down and the 12 disciples with him. And he said to them, "With fervent desire, I have desired to eat this Passover with you before I suffer. For I say to you, I will no longer eat of it until it is fulfilled in the kingdom of God." Amazing that in Jesus' love in this time, he expresses his compassion, his care for them, his fervency. I mean, here is the King of the universe, the Creator of all things, desiring to have this last Passover meal. Now, it will be the last Passover meal that he'll partake with them. Thus, it will be the last cup of blessing that he'll, begin with them or have with them until the time. It says he took the cup and gave thanks and said, "Take this and divide it among yourselves. For I say to you, I will not drink of the fruit of the vine until the kingdom of God comes." So again, that picture now of, the Passover's begun. Now, this first cup is where really they would start the Passover meal, the first cup of blessing. And then there are actually four cups in the Passover meal. Luke only records two at this point. But there are four cups in the full meal. And it's an elaborate ceremony that's quite interesting. In fact, we are going to have Mitch Glazer from Chosen People here again this Passover season to go through some of the portrayal. In other words, he's going to set up a table up here, and he will describe all the different emblems of the Seder meal. Now, the only difference is you won't be eating the meal. It won't be a dinner for you to eat. It's just going to be on the table up here in demonstration. But he's going to show you how this fits with the gospel message and the fact of who Jesus the Messiah is. It is a fascinating insight. I know when God established the deliverance from Egypt, he was looking ahead to what the real deliverance would be, delivering people out of this world and through the blood of the Lamb that takes away the sin of the world, as John the Baptist described. Behold the Lamb of God. Jesus is that Lamb, that Passover Lamb. And so he is sharing this with him with fervent desire. He's sharing with his disciples these things. And then he took the bread and gave thanks, notice, and he gave it to them, saying, "This is my body, which is given for you. Do this in remembrance of me." Now, at that time in the meal, this is an amazing time. They would take the bread before the meal, the three matzahs, and they take the middle one and break it in half. Then they would wrap it in a napkin called the afikomen, and then they would hide it away for a while. And at the end of the meal, they would bring it out, and then they would break it, and then they would partake of that middle matzo. Now, the average Jewish person has no clue why they do this. It's just a ceremony. It's part of the Haggadah. You know, they go through all this. They don't know a lot of the symbolism behind it. But to me, it is amazing that you've got these three matzahs, which to me represent, of course, the unleavened bread was symbolic of the fact they had to leave Egypt in a hurry and their bread didn't have a time to rise. So that they take unleavened bread in celebrating this. Leaven's a type of sin, so it's unleavened. There's no leaven in it. In fact, before even the meal, they have to go through the house and find all the leaven and get rid of it. Then they can start the Passover meal. But so it's a representative of sinlessness. Here you've got three of them. Well, there's only one sinless, and that's God. Why would they be three matzahs? And why would they take the middle one, which to me is too much a picture of the Son, and break it, a picture of his death, bury it in linen for a while, symbolism of the burial, and then bring it out afterwards and it would give nourishment to the people. Now, it's a fascinating emblem, but Mitch will do a much better job than I did in just a few minutes of describing this. Anyway, this is the bread that he took and gave thanks and he gave it to them saying, "This is my body given for you. Do this in remembrance of me." And likewise, he took the cup after supper. Now, that would have been the third cup, which just happens to be the cup of redemption. The third cup, after supper, saying, "This cup is the new covenant in my blood, which is shed for you." Now, Jesus institutes this and says, "Do this in remembrance of me." So he institutes it as a memorial. Later, Paul the Apostle in 1 Corinthians 11 says, "What I've received from the Lord, I'm delivering to you," that in the night he was betrayed, he took bread, he broke it, said, he gave thanks, "This is my body broken for you," and likewise he took the cup, and he goes through this. And as often as you do, do this in remembrance of me. Now, how often do we celebrate communion? Well, it's kind of up to, your understanding of what Jesus meant by do it as often as you do. Did he say do it as often as you want? Did he imply it to mean do it when you do the Passover? That's part of the ceremony. And understand it there. So once a year. Or as some do, they kind of put a schedule on, as once a month we do it here, just to bring back to our remembrance these things. Now, Jesus goes on and in the next few passages describes during this meal, as they're finishing up this meal, a number of things happen. In fact, this is quite an evening of revelation. A number of things are revealed. First, about the betrayer. Notice, "Behold, the hand of my betrayer is with me on the table. And truly the Son of Man goes as it has been determined. But woe to that man by whom he is betrayed." Then they began to question among themselves which of them it was who would do this thing. You know, when you think about this treachery of Judas, you have to have just kind of a thought. I mean, here's a guy that it was predetermined that he was going to be the betrayer. I mean, he was the son of perdition. Judas was possessed by Satan to do that dirty deed. But why is it? When I think about this, he says it's been determined that this man will do this, but woe to that man by whom it's been determined. If it's been determined ahead of time, and Judas is just there and he's the guy, how can you blame him? It's a philosophical thought that really makes you think, and it also makes you even go back to the beginning of Adam and Eve. If God knew ahead of time that Adam and Eve were going to sin, why would he even create us in the beginning? If he knew that what was going to happen would be so horrible in this world, why would he do it? You know, it's a good question, really. Interestingly enough, I know a doctor who was ministering to a woman who lost a child in a very tragic accident, a very cruel, horrible way to die for this little one in this accident. And she really was struggling with that and thought, why would you allow this, God? God, why did you let this happen? As many times when things happen in our lives, we ask that question. Well, he didn't really know what to say. I don't know, but the Lord ministered to his heart to ask her a question. It says, if you could go back before you had any children, you have three other children. If you could go back before you had any children, and you could be, it could be revealed to you that before you even had children, the child that you would have, one of your children would suffer and die such a cruel death. And you could say at that point, okay, I'm not going to have children. Would you choose to not have children, knowing that having children, one of them would die such a horrible death? She said, oh, no. No, I would definitely have children. My children are such a source of joy and such a source of comfort and encouragement to me. Of course I would. Even knowing my one child would die like this, I still would have children. You know, it's really kind of your answer also. Why did God? Yes, we know things are going to happen. Now, you could even go on to say, well, is it fair then that Judas should suffer punishment for that which it was predetermined he would do? Is it fair? And then likewise, you could say, since we're born in sin, we're going to be sinners. How can we be accountable for being a sinner if we're born in sin? Why is it our fault? We were born in sin, so I'm going to sin. How can I be faulted for that? It's not my fault. I was born that way. So how can I be punished with hell? It's not fair. Hell is not fair. Until you realize. You see, what would be fair? What would be fair? How about this? For that sin, how about if God takes the punishment for that sin? Would that be fair? How about if he takes that punishment so that you don't have to be punished for that sin? Would that be fair? Absolutely. Well, you've just discovered the gospel. That's exactly what God has done. He has taken the punishment of sin upon himself. He sent his son. Now, if you refuse that gift, you've got no one to blame for going to hell but yourself. And Judas had no one to blame but himself because he had every opportunity, having the very Son of God with all the miracles there present, but in his hardness of heart, he chose. Woe to that man. Dante's Inferno describes the spiraling down of hell, and at the bottom, Satan is chewing up Judas. Now, there was also a dispute among them as to which of them should be considered the greatest. Here these guys are getting this profound revelation of what's going to take place, the betrayer of the Lord. He gives them this Last Supper, and they're worried about who's going to be the greatest in the coming kingdom. I think I have a theory for why this was an argument, why this was an issue with them. At the table, when you'd sit at the Roman triclinium table, there was kind of a pecking order. In other words, you had the guest of honor. The host would be there, and the guest of honor would be on his right. The second guest of honor would be on his left, and then onward down to the least important of the guests. That's why Jesus said, you know, when you come into a room, don't take a high position of honor because then they might have to move you. So you don't belong here. You're going to have to go down there, and you'll be embarrassed. He says, take the lowest seat, and then maybe someone who comes in says, hey, you shouldn't be sitting there. Take a higher seat, and you'll be honored by taking the lowest. Well, it's quite probable that, well, we already know from John's gospel, we know where at least three people were sitting, four people, including Jesus. He would have had, of course, the highest honor in that position. You would have had John, the apostle, on his right, because it says he leaned on his chest. And on the left, you would have Judas, because he was there to dip the bread with him in that same little bowl. Now, where's the other one? Well, we get the idea from John's gospel that Peter was directly across from them, so he would have been actually at the last position on the table. Now, that doesn't sound like Peter, does it? Peter seems like, you know, he'd be pushing his way up there, but I think he's trying to be a nice guy, trying to be a servant. But the problem is when you try to be a servant when you're really not, you're going to advertise to everybody just how much of a servant you are. You know, look at me, I'm sweeping up the bathrooms. Look at me, I'm picking up the paper. Look at me, I'm being a servant type of thing. It's part of our human nature, unfortunately. Well, Peter apparently was making some comments, and the discussion came up that, you know, he's making everybody know he shouldn't be here. You know, I don't really belong in this spot. The argument comes up, well, who is the greatest? Then he said to them, the kings of the Gentiles exercise lordship over them, and those who exercise authority over them are called benefactors, but not so among you. On the contrary, he who is greatest among you, let him be as the younger. In the culture, the younger was usually the one who received the least amount of inheritance. The elder brother received the double portion. The younger, nothing, you know, next to nothing. So he's basically got the no rights situation. He's at the benevolence of the older. And he who governs as one who serves. See, when you have that position of leading, then you really need to be a servant. For who is greater, he who sits at the table or he who serves? Is it not he who sits at the table? Yet I am among you as one who serves. John's Gospel tells us in John 13 that Jesus at this point, after the supper, arose and girded himself with a towel and began to wash his disciples' feet. Amazing to me. It was after dinner, because in that culture, of course, it was the servant's job to clean the feet before you sat down to the table. That would be especially important the way they sat at the table, because they didn't sit with their feet under, carefully tucked under. You reclined on a bench, and your feet were not far from somebody else's face. And after walking in those dusty rolls with all the animal droppings, you know, generally you would want to have clean feet before you ate, but no one wanted to do it. You see, it was somebody's business that should have been everybody's business, but when it's everybody's business, it's nobody's business. You know how that works. No one wants to do it because somebody else should have done it. And because somebody didn't, nobody did. Somebody wouldn't, so nobody did. Those are the only two active people in church sometimes, you know. Anyway, these guys took that position of, I'm not going to do it. And Jesus then began to wash their feet and startled them, blew their mind. Of course, Peter protested, you're not going to wash my feet. And Jesus said, well, if you don't let me wash your feet, then you'll have no part in me. And of course, Peter says, then give me a bath. Wash everything. You know, I want everything. And Jesus says, no, he who has been cleansed only needs his feet to be cleansed. Now, I think there's a very significant point about this, and especially as it occurs here in the communion table, the idea of washing feet. Now, we don't have a foot washing ceremony for a number of reasons. I don't believe Jesus instituted a foot washing ceremony. Some people do. And they have foot washing ceremonies. The problem with the foot washing ceremony is that when you come, it's kind of just a pretext, you know, like, okay, I'm going to show what a servant I am by washing everybody's feet. And then really, your feet won't need to be washed because you'll probably come with the cleanest feet you've had in years. So it just becomes a ceremony. But there's a significant purpose behind it. You see, when Jesus spoke about them being cleansed, he said, the word of God has cleansed you. You know, they became, you know, the people of God by believing in him. They were saved in that respect. But just as you, when you believe in Jesus and you're saved, when you go out into the world and you're in commerce and school and the various things you do, you oftentimes get defiled. Sin enters back in the picture. Your feet get dirty, so to speak. And you know you need someone to wash your feet. So you come back into the fellowship, and you know, here's where the need is when we gather together, is that are we really serving one another? Are we ministering to one another? Are we praying for one another? Are we encouraging one another? Do we have people that we've been able to confess our faults to and you know, hey, I've really blown it, and pray for me, and be have our feet washed? I think what happens sometimes is when we come in, like in the early church when Paul had to write to the Corinthians, they didn't get it. They were selfish. They came thinking of themselves. Who's going to bless me? Who's going to minister to me? If we come into church with that attitude, we're coming in with the wrong attitude. Because then we'll be critical.
Well, the music was okay today. It wasn't as better as it was good as, you know, I've seen it better. And the pastor was okay. You know, I didn't particularly care for that illustration he made. But,
you know, we become critical. Instead of, Lord, what are you trying to say to us? What are you ministering? What are you expressing? Lord, what do you want me to be toward others? So when you come in, I want you to come in to church with a mentality that says, you know what? Who can I bless? Who can I minister to? Whose feet can I wash? And you look around, who's it going to be? who can I minister to? Is there anybody that seems sad? Let me go up to that person and encourage them. Is there anybody that seems like no one's talking to them? Let me reach out to that person. And you know what? There's how we wash each other's feet and we become servants to one another and encouraging one another. Do you know the funny thing is? Being a servant will lead you into the happiest life you've ever had. I can tell you who the most miserable people are. It's the people who are coming in thinking, you know, no one's here blessing me. No one's ministering to me. No one talked to me. No one's reaching out to me because they're thinking of themselves. Forget yourself. Minister to others. Even if you're a visitor, you'd be surprised. It's the best way to meet people. Just, you know, reach out. Because chances are there's tons of visitors around and you don't even know it. Point is this. Jesus came as one who serves. He says, but you are those who have continued with me in my trials and I bestow upon you a kingdom just as my Father bestowed one upon me. That you may eat and drink at my table in my kingdom and sit down on the thrones judging the 12 tribes of Israel. So, hey, you're coming now to serve, but yes, I know. You've come and you've endured with me and you're going to be bestowed upon the kingdom and you're going to eat and drink together and you'll sit and you'll enjoy that reward in heaven in due time. Then the Lord said to Simon, Simon, indeed, Satan has asked for you that he may sift you as wheat. You know, Satan got Judas and he's asking for you. He says, but I have prayed for you that your faith should not fail. And when you have returned to me, strengthen your brethren. So the indication that Peter would stumble and yet need to return to Jesus. An indication that Peter would deny him. Peter protests this idea of having to return because he's thinking, I'll never leave. He says, Lord, I'm ready to go with you, both to prison and to death. Peter didn't know himself very well. And if any fault of his, it was probably that. It's probably our biggest fault. We really don't know ourselves like we should. We think ourselves more spiritual, more noble, more strong than we really are. And hence we don't depend upon the Lord. And here Peter was self-confident. That's not the thing that the Lord wants from us. He wants us to be confident in Him, but beware of self-confidence. Now the world will look at you with the confidence you have in the Lord, and they will think it's self-confidence. It will look like self-confidence, but you know who you're really trusting in. It's not you. Well, he said, I tell you, Peter, the rooster shall not crow this day before you will deny me three times that you know me. Wow. Then he said to them, and we'll pick up on Peter's denial later on, but this is the revelation tonight for Peter to learn. He needs to learn a little bit about himself. Then he said to them, when I sent you without money, bag, knapsack, and sandals, did you lack anything? And he said, nothing. Then he said to him, but now he who has a money bag, let him take it, and likewise a knapsack, and he who has no sword, let him sell his garment and buy one. For I say to you this, that all that is written must be accomplished in me, and he was numbered with the transgressors, for the things concerning me have an end. So they said, Lord, look, here are two swords. And he said to them, it is enough. This has got to be one of the most misunderstood passages in all the Bible, especially since part of church history misunderstood this to the point of causing atrocities that are still spoken about in history classes. The crusade period, the crusaders period, as they went to try to conquer with the sword, thinking that Jesus has authorized them to use the sword into reaching people for the gospel. That's not even close to what Jesus is saying. In fact, when you read this, you need to read this also with comparing with what he says later. Now, when the disciples come and say, look, here's a couple of swords. Jesus says it is enough. Well, that's not the best expression of that Greek phrase that he's using. It could also be expressed, and probably more accurately, as enough already. In other words, you guys missed the point. How do we know that's probably a better translation? Because when you go into the Garden of Gethsemane, you find that the disciples did miss the point. When they came to arrest Jesus, who was it that grabbed the sword? Peter. And what did he do with that sword, being such a remarkable swordsman as he was? He was able just to cut off the ear of one servant of the high priest, and that was it. And even Jesus healed that man's ear. But that was the extent of what Peter could do in his own strength. Now, what did Jesus tell Peter? Put away your sword. In other words, Peter, you missed it. You're enough already. Just as he says here, enough. You guys are not getting it. You know, the point is, he provided for them supernaturally, but the days are coming when they're going to have to think of taking care of those necessities. And a sword oftentimes would be used for protecting yourself against animals and just a common piece that you would use. So there's no indication that he's intending them to use the sword to fight in a physical way, because the weapons of our warfare, the Bible tells us, are not carnal. They're not fleshly. They're not guns and knives. But they're mighty for the pulling down of strongholds. Prayer is our greatest weapon. The Word of God, which is the sword of the Spirit. And it's a two-edged sword, and able to cut between the division between soul and spirit, both joints and marrow, and able to discern the thoughts and the intents of the heart. That's the way the Lord conquers. He pricks the conscience. He pierces our hearts with a sword, and he reveals the intents in the hearts and the desires, so that we see who we really are, and we will come to him, and he conquers us with his love. So they missed the point. Jesus said, hey, I could call down 12 legions of angels with my help, but I lay my life down. He was the good shepherd who laid his life down for the sheep. So he said, enough. They missed the point. So this was quite a night of revelation. And I hope that as we partake of communion, it will be a time of revelation for us. As we ask the Lord to search our hearts, as we realize what Jesus gave and those emblems of the cup and of the bread, the body which is broken for us, the bread represents that, and the cup of juice that we have representing the blood that was shed. But before we jump in, maybe there are some here who have not yet come to know the Lord. Maybe there are some here that you're visiting, or you have not yet come to acknowledge Jesus as your Lord and Savior. If you don't know the Lord, the door is wide open for you to know the Lord. God is not willing that any should perish. Yes, you might say it's not fair that I should be threatened with hell if I don't believe in God. And yet, think about this. Hell is coming. You were born in sin. You're going to be accountable for that sin, even if you think it's not fair, but God took the penalty. Why don't you accept his free gift and come to acknowledge him as your Lord? Don't harden your heart against him.